Okay, our parsha is Parshat Behalotcha. The first commandment in the parsha is lighting the candles of the menorah. Lighting the candles of the menorah was performed classically every evening. The Kohen, the parsha describes the Kohen Gadol, but actually every Kohen could come in and light the menorah. And then in the morning, after the menorah was lit all night long in the holy, just outside the Holy of Holies, so then the Kohen would come in and prepare all the wicks and light it again tomorrow in the afternoon. According to Maimonides' opinion, it was lit in the morning and the evening. When they would prepare the wicks in the morning, they would actually relight it in the morning. According to Rambam, it was lit twice a day. The description of the menorah in our parsha does not seem to fit in. We finished describing the vessels of the Mishkan. The Rambam, when he discusses what a Beit HaMikdash looks like, the Rambam discusses there is a lamp with lit candles, with lit wicks. This is part of how the Beit HaMikdash has to look. And perhaps this is a message. My father, he should live and be well, always was careful that on Shabbat we have light on in the house. And we didn't have Shabbos clocks. All night long the light was on. My father would say, Shabbat this year, there should be light. You get up in the middle of the night, you want to read something, you have light. The lights shouldn't go off. So there's a message in terms of the lights being lit. Now there's a Medrash Rabbah here that always gives me encouragement. One of my favorite Midrashim is on this week's parsha. The Medrash says that we read the commandment to make the menorah out of one slab. And it's a very specific, intricate description. So some of the commentaries say, today we look at lamps, and everyone knows what a lamp looks like. We have a Hanukkah menorah, we have a regular menorah, it's minted on the coin. And some of the commentaries say that before this commandment, no one made lamps that way. It's only after in the Mishkan they had a lamp with branches and a central branch that it became an in thing over the years that other places adopted this type of a lamp. However, earlier people did not make lamps this way. But the Medrash says the following. The Medrash says Moshe Rabbeinu was given instructions how to make the menorah with all its details. He heard the lesson and he left and he started going down the mountain. And then he stopped and he said, wait, went back up the mountain and said, Rabbon Shalom, I'm sorry, I know you explained it to me. I need you to explain it again. So the Rabbon Shalom explained it a second time. And Moshe Rabbeinu again started descending the mountain. And then he said, wait. He went back up the mountain and he said, Rabbon Shalom, I know you explained it to me twice. I need you to explain it to me a third time. And again, the Rabbon Shalom explained it to Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu said, okay, thank you, now I got it. And he went down the mountain and then he stopped. And he said, wait, I don't get it. And he went back up the mountain a fourth time. And he said, Rabbon Shalom, I know you explained it to me three times. Three times I said I understood. But I need you to explain to me again. And the Rabbon Shalom said, never mind. And here there are different endings to the Medrash. One ending is the Rabbon Shalom said, I'll do it. And Moshe took a slab of gold and put it in the fire and it came out the menorah. But there's another medrash that says, go down and talk to Bezalel and you'll see it'll work. Now, Bezalel was the son of Uri, the son of Hur, the son of Miriam and Kalev. Kalev was all of 40 years old when he was this great-grandfather. So Bezalel was a youngster, he was a minor, 10, 12, 13, he was very young when he was building the Mishkan. And Moshe comes down the mountain after being taught by Hashem, the best educator, and he starts telling Bezalel, Hashem told me to build the menorah. And Hashem said like this, like that, and Bezalel says, oh, you mean like this, you mean like, yeah, I got it. So Moshe stood there dumbfounded. He had gotten three lessons from the Rabbon Shalom himself, and he couldn't do it. And Bezalel was getting things through Moshe, and he got it. And he knew exactly what Hashem wanted. And Moshe said, yeah, you're right, that's what Hashem said. The Medrash says, it teaches us we have different talents. Even Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have the talents of Bezalel. Sometimes we see someone else, and they get it with a snap. And we work hard again and again and again, and we don't get it. So of course we have to invest our efforts and try to get it. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't give up. He tried the first time, he tried the second time, he tried the third time. He kept trying. However, when we see that other people get it much more easily than we do, so this medrash is the medrash of encouragement for me, at least. The idea that even Moshe Rabbeinu had things that he had to go back and say, wait, can you explain that again to me, please? Hashem tells Moshe, take the Levites from within the Jews and purify them, and then they will be designated for their service. And part of the preparation of the Levites was that they would remove all hairs. Rashi over here quotes a medrash. He says, I found in the works of Rabbi Moshe Adarshan that being that the Levites would be in exchange for the firstborn, and the firstborn had lost their rights to the service because they had worshipped idols. Idols are called zivchei metim, deceased, sacrifices to the dead. And a person who has tzaras is also called dead. So they are separating like a person who's separating from tzaras, because they're separate. They're instead of the firstborn who worshipped idols, who are defiled like a person who has tzaras. Boy, look at that long medrash. So that's why they had to shave off all their head. Their head, their beards. It says Korach came home. His wife said, who shaved you like a cucumber? No hair, right? His long white beard was shaved. His head was beard was shaved. So Rashi quotes this medrash. But what's interesting is that this medrash has halachic ramifications in a few places. It says that in ancient times, when a person would come to convert from Christianity, or from paganism, so part of their conversion would involve shaving all their hair. Based on this, if the Levites are coming instead of the firstborn who worshipped idols, then the Levites, who are now going to become holy, have to shave all their hair. So when a person would convert, they would have them shave all their hair, and this is quoted in the Ramon, Shulchan Aruch. There are courts that till today ask the convert to take a very close haircut and shave the hair on their head and their beard. That goes back to this custom. What's interesting is that it's not only a convert. If there was a Jew who had adopted a paganistic lifestyle or adopted Christianity, they would not count him for a minyan. They wouldn't let him become part of the congregation again until he would shave his hair and immerse in a mikvah, based on this Rashi. And it's quoted again in Shulchan Aruch, and it's quoted in the laws of Chol HaMoed, where it says that although on Chol HaMoed you're not supposed to shave or take a haircut, but if there's a Jew who wants to rejoin the congregation and he hasn't done it yet, so now on Chol HaMoed he wakes up, he wants to join, so he goes and shaves and takes his haircut and immerses in the mikvah because he has no other way to rejoin the congregation. So this minhag, based on this midrash, is quoted in both places in the Shulchan Aruch.
As halacha.
Minhag is halacha, and this is a minhag that's quoted, yes. Yes, sir.
Since when did we use a razor to cut the hair?
Where Hashem commanded us to do it.
I mean, since when?
The Torah prohibits it. Already in Achrimos Kedoshim, the Torah prohibits using a razor.
Yes, but now you're telling me that they have to shave their hair.
Right. So how do you know it wasn't with scissors?
I don't know.
Okay.
So you have.
So the pasuk says, "Ve'eviru tar al kol b'saram." That's how we know.
Tar is not a scissor.
Right. What does tar mean? The Torah says they should place a knife over all their flesh and cut off all their hair. So the Torah says they used a blade. But that's the answer to your question. How do we know they did it? Because the Torah said it. Why were they allowed to do it? Because the Torah said it. Okay, so the Levites came forward. The Jews would place their hands on them. Aaron lifted each Levite. This was another point that Korach's wife got upset about. She said, he's making fun of you. He's tossing you around like a ball. Think about what might. Aaron HaKohen, he's an old man. He's over 80. He's lifting every Levite. And then the Levites would lean on the animals and bring their sacrifice.
Is he lifting or lifting?
I think lifting. It says he lifted and moved them.
does that have to mean he actually touched them?
Sounds that way. They need. That's what Chazal seemed to tell us. Yud Aleph, the beginning of the parasha before Sheni. Okay. Now the Torah gives us a warning. The Levites will watch the Mishkan, and there won't be a plague against Am Yisrael, that they will protect the Jews from coming too close. However, the Levites who were there would die. Meaning we have a tradition that the reason the Levites had a smaller number was because they served next to the Mishkan, and any mistake was lethal. You took a wrong step, just like we see the story of Uzzah. He tries to support the ark, but he shouldn't have touched the ark, and he drops dead. So it's very scary. You know, it's like working in a nuclear power plant. Any mistake can be lethal. So the Levites purify themselves, they shave, they immerse, and they are designated for their service. The Torah describes that the Levites come to serve from age 25. And then the Torah says that they serve from age 30. So what are they coming at age 25 for? So the Talmud says they're coming at age 25 to study. From age 25 to 30, they would study for 5 years. And then, if they knew their stuff, they could serve. So I want to quote that Gemara to you. Gemara in Hulin. But you gotta stick around until we read Rashi on the Gemara, okay? If you're gonna walk out either before the Gemara or after Rashi, but not in between. You know, Rav Yosef Karo, when he quotes a Gemara, always quotes Rashi. It's as though you can't learn Gemara without Rashi. So here too, we're going to read that Gemara and then read Rashi. So the Gemara says like this. One verse says, "Mibin chamesh v'slim shana v'mala," from age 25 and up. This is tractate Chulin 24a. Ve'katuv echad omer, and a verse we learned earlier in the book of Bamidbar says, "Mibin shloshim," the Levites start their service at age 30. If shalomar shloshim, you can't just say 30. Shekvanemar slim chamesh. You have a verse that says 25. If shalomar slim chamesh, you can't say 25. Shekvanemar shloshim. The verse says 30. How do I reconcile the two verses? Haketzad, chafei lilmod, v'shloshim la'avodah. At age 25 they come to learn, at age 30 they start working. Mikan, from here we learn, letalmid shelo ra'a siman yafeh b'mishnato chamesh shanim. If you have a student who hasn't seen success in his learning of Mishnah after 5 years, shuv eino ro'eh, then he shouldn't expect it anymore. So a guy might say, wait a second. I spent 5 years at Mahon Meir, and I'm still not the chief rabbi of Israel. So obviously I should call it quits. Explains Rashi. Shelo ra'a siman yafeh, lomed v'shochecho. If a person sees that for 5 years, when they learn how to wash their hands in the morning, they keep forgetting. They learn how to put on their tefillin, they keep forgetting. They learn how to build the sukkah, they keep forgetting. Every mitzvah they learn, they forget. Then you realize you're not cut out for learning. But we don't have that. Meaning Rashi's talking about the service of building, dismantling, carrying, the opening a gate, closing a gate, singing a song. What were the Levites' duties? So if you spend 5 years learning how to build a tent and you couldn't get it, so then okay, right, you didn't get it. But we don't have that here. None of us can say we spent 5 years learning an area of Torah and we don't remember it. We remember more, we remember less. We don't invest as much time, we're not focused, we don't review. When the Gemara derives from here, after 5 years, you know you're cut out. You're not cut out for it. The Gemara is saying, if a guy has a learning disability, the guy sees he really has no retention. Okay, that's what the Gemara is talking about. It's not talking about the average guy who sits down and learns. He learns. And when we don't remember, it's because we're trying to accomplish too much and we review too little. So we don't remember. Of course we don't remember. They didn't remember this either. I have a friend who, I had a friend, we haven't been in touch in years, but I had a friend who, when he was 14, 15, he was already writing commentary to the response of the giants of the day. He wrote different rabbis who wrote responsa, he'd write them letters questioning their responsa from sources all over Shas. So he's a super genius. And I once asked him how he learns. He said, all day. I said, how much do you cover in a day? So he didn't answer me so much. So I said, you know, I'm trying to remember what I learned. And I learn between a page and a half of Talmud a day. I'm learning and reviewing and learning again and reviewing again and reviewing what I learned yesterday. Da, da, da. So he said, a page and a half? How could you retain a page and a half? I said, what do you mean? You know, I think at age 14, if he mastered Shas, he must have... So he said, I never did more than half of one, maximum one side of a page all day. Full day, learning, reviewing, and learning again, and reviewing again. I never did more than one side of a page in my learning.
When you say one page, you mean?
I mean, two sides, two and a half sides. Saying two sides plus another. So to me, I was doing seven pages a day. And I told him what I was working on remembering, not what I was learning. But he said, there's no way I'd remember that. So then I said, okay, maybe that's why he remembers. You know, he's learning an amount that he can retain. So one of the reasons we don't retain is because we try to conquer too much, we review too little, and we invest too little. We move on. At 50 years old, the Torah says they stop working and they start serving. So what does that mean? So they help and they consult. There comes a stage where you can't do what everyone else can do, but you can help. And very often you can give advice that will make it for other people.
So they wouldn't be like removed from Avodah.
Correct, correct. They didn't carry the loads
but
on their shoulders. Well, they could still sing if they had a voice, and they could still be in charge of the gates. They could still help load and unload.
This would be like teaching?
Not only teaching, they also... they played supportive roles. They weren't...
They have experience, they know their job, they can teach
new
ones.
Yeah. Okay, we're up to Shlishi. And now the Torah tells us it's the second year, the first month, we've reverted back to Nisan of the second year. Now if you open up the book of Bamidbar, the beginning of the book of Bamidbar was already in Iyar, the second month. So the Torah went back a month. The Torah moved forward two parashiyot and suddenly goes back a month from the beginning of the book of Bamidbar. So this is one of the sources, this is a blatant source for the concept, Ein Mukdam Umulchal Batorah, that the words of Torah are not necessarily written in chronological order. Sometimes you have something that's written later and it happened earlier. Now there's an argument between Nachmanides, the Ramban, and the Ibn Ezra. Ramban was a very big fan of the great rabbi, Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra. Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra was a great sage who also knew Kabbalah, who was also a great poet, who was also extraordinarily poor, and every endeavor he tried failed miserably, to the point that he wrote a song and he said if he would sell shrouds for the dead, people would stop dying. If he would sell candles, the sun would stop setting. He's come to a conclusion that God doesn't want him to succeed making money. So that's the song he wrote. Yes, he was very poetic. So the Ramban was a great admirer of the Ibn Ezra, even though throughout his commentary, the Ramban takes issue with the Ibn Ezra in numerous places. So the Ibn Ezra and the Ramban have the following dispute. We have places in the Medrash, in the Medrash Rabbah, and in the Gemara, in the Talmud, where our sages tell us, this is written out of order. You're reading the story here, you should know it really happened at a different time. So we know there are places where the sages said, En mukdamu mulchal batorah. The words of Torah are written out of chronological order in this segment. What happens when we think so? What happens when we don't have a tradition that this piece of the Torah is written out of chronological order? So that's an argument between the Ibn Ezra and the Ramban. Do we have the license in our own interpretation to say this is written out of order?
He says what?
If I remember correctly, the Ibn Ezra says we may, and the Ramban says we may not.
Like, why couldn't you say this about the 30 and the 25? Like, they started at 25.
That's not out of order, though. That's a contradiction. Yes?
The one who's against, how does he explain the first verse in the book of Mishnah?
No, so here Chazal say it. Where our sages say it, for sure there are places where Chazal say it, and that's written out of order. The question is, where we don't have a tradition that it's out of order, are we allowed to say, in our own understanding, that we think that's also out of order? Here our sages said it's written out of order. This is the prime source for the concept. The question is, where I don't have a source from the sages, where it doesn't say it in Medrash and it does not say it in Talmud, am I allowed to say, I think this parsha happened at a different time in the Torah?
So you say there's a source, there's no argument.
If you have a source, then of course, then Chazal said it.
But even if we don't have one of the sources, how would you explain the first word?
Okay, so here the text says it.
Right.
It says specifically blah 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 in the second year. And you only have 3 months in the chronological, 3 months in the desert.
Over here it's written overtly, you're right.
It's a holy thing.
I'm saying it like also for high level. If I can read it like this, and it's like.
Is Chazal trying to explain why this part was written on a card, or did he just accept it?
So Chazal tell us that the ordering of the Torah, it has specific intent, and the intent is not chronology. The Torah is written in a specific order where Hashem wanted certain concepts to be juxtaposed. We have a concept called simuchim, that sometimes the Torah said, you see, this concept is next to that concept, learn from that. The idea of having things juxtaposed teaches me something. In the beginning of our parsha, we have the commandment of the menorah. It would seem that that commandment happened already in the book of Shmos, when we had the whole Mishkan, the commandments of the Mishkan. However, the Torah juxtaposed it with the commandments of the Levites to tell you in other areas the Levites were help. Behalotcha tanerot, this is yours, Aaron. And this is the famous Medrash that when Aaron saw all the other tribes bringing their donations, he said, why don't I have a section with that? Why does every tribe get to bring their donation at the inauguration of the Mishkan and my tribe hasn't brought anything? And Hashem answered him, Shechag dola mishelahim. They inaugurate once, you inaugurate daily. With your lighting of the Mishkan, it's like a renewed inauguration of the Mishkan. The light is being turned on. Okay, so we have the commandment of the Paschal offering. And the Torah says, Bimoado. Bring the Paschal offering in its set time. So at this point, the Jews have not yet paused from circumcising. So they're bringing the Paschal offering. Shortly, after Parshat Be'alotcha, we reach Parshat Shlach. We learn about the unfortunate occurrence of the spies. And from that point onward, where we are banished to the desert for 40 years, there will not be a northerly wind. And it will pose a medical threat to circumcised children. And so from next week's parsha onward, the Jewish people cease to circumcise their kids for the 40 years in the desert. And over here, this is our last opportunity where everyone is fully circumcised. And we are commanded to bring the Paschal offering. The Torah says, Bimoado. Whenever the Torah says, in its set time, the Torah is saying, even on Shabbos. This transcends Shabbos. The Torah says, adhere to the laws. So we know that we eat matzah for 7 days. We know that the sheep has to be whole. We know they couldn't have chametz in their possession. and Moshe commands the Jewish people, and we have this wonderful celebration of Pesach in the desert. Think about it, a full year has passed. It must have been a very exciting Pesach, the first Pesach that they're celebrating. Last year we did this for real. This year, it's a memory. Right? Last year, think of the first year, 1968, on Yom Yerushalayim. Right? So last year, this was real. So, there are Jews who celebrate the day they were liberated from the camps. So if they celebrated the first year is different than every other year. It's the first time you get to look at it as a memory. So that's what the Jews had here. And so there were people who could not participate. Who were these people? So these were the people who had carried Nadav and Avihu out of the camp when they had died. So they said, Lama Nigara, why should we be left out? And that's a very important line. Chazal say, in spiritual matters, we should feel that way. Why shouldn't I have some of that? There's the famous story of Rav Mordechai Gifter. You know Rav Mordechai Gifter? He was a young man. And one day, in MTA, Yeshiva University's high school, the Rebbe walked in and he said, we're getting a new young man to class from the Midwest. We're talking about in the 1920s, okay? Said, we're getting a new young man. He doesn't know too much about Torah. Please be nice to him. So Max Gifter came to Yeshiva University's high school. And Max Gifter, that's how he walked in. And he was a student. And in those days, they started having photographs, right? So he obtained photographs of different Talmidei Chachamim of the time. And one day, a friend of his comes to the room, and really Max is much less than all the other guys. He's got a fiery personality, but he really doesn't know what everyone else knows. So he's got a lot of catching up to do. And he sees that right above his bed is a frame. There are a bunch of pictures forming a frame. And in the middle of this box of pictures, there's a note. And on that note, it says, why not me? That's what was over his bed. So the guy looks at him and he says, Max, you know, you're a nice guy, but there's a whole class here and you're not exactly the top of it. He shrugged. He didn't answer him. But Max Gifter went on to become one of the greatest Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Mordechai Gifter, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Telsh Yeshiva, who was admired not only by his yeshiva and then ended up building a yeshiva in Chicago and in Israel, but also was revered in the universities around. They used to ask him to come in and give speeches on Shakespeare. Everyone valued him. So Rabbi Mordechai Gifter said, Lama Nigara, why should we be left out? When we see greatness, spiritual greatness, that's where we have to say, why not me? You know, kids, when they see everyone else getting dessert, they say, well, what about me? Right, everyone else got a treat for Shabbos. What about me? The Torah tells us that on spiritual things, a person's supposed to say that. Well, what about me? Chazal say, you see your friends going to do a mitzvah. Then you should say, well, what about me? That's Chesron lo yuchal li'manot. The pasuk says in Koheles, Chazal say that's a person who had an opportunity. He saw his friends. Now, I want you to stop and look around. You see this building? Not one person built this building. Machon Meir, Rav Bigon had a lot to do with building Machon Meir. But he didn't do it alone. There were people who wanted to partner and help this become a reality. And there were different people. When good things happen, it involves overcoming hurdles, but it also involves a lot of people who say, I want to be a part of that. If you see the establishment of this community, this Kiryat Moshe, the state of Israel, whatever you see, I used to love looking at the Twin Towers. I would come to Yeshiva, Rabbi Feinstein's Yeshiva on 145 East Broadway, and I'd stand there with my hand on the door, and I'd take a look at the Twin Towers, and then I'd walk into Yeshiva. And I always said the Twin Towers is a show of what unity can accomplish. No one person can build that. There's no one human being. If he dedicates his whole life, he cannot build the Twin Towers. No one can do that. That's only the unification of thousands and thousands of people. And then you can build such a thing. So every time I'd look at it, the Twin Towers, you'd see them in the clouds sometimes. Sometimes you really couldn't see the top because it was covered with clouds. And I'd always stop and look at that and remind myself the importance of Achdus. You got to get the humanity, when it gets together, can accomplish a lot. Lama nigara. Very often it's tempting to look at things and say, it's functioning, what does it have to do with me? You daven in a shul? Try to find out if you could be one of the people who help clean, who help prepare the shul. You should be a part of making it function. You're in a yeshiva, see what you can do to help. When people leave after davening, you could be the guy who forgets a sitter in this place. You could be the guy who puts back his sitter. You could be the guy who takes 1 minute and cleans up the whole shul and gathers the sidurim and puts them away. You just became a partner. If you see something you value, lama nigara, why shouldn't I be a part of that? I had an interesting conversation this past Shabbos. Someone came with a complaint about the shul. So I was a little bit fed up when he came. So the poor guy, I actually gave him a piece of my mind. So the guy came with a complaint. I listened to the complaint. And he finished talking, and I said, okay. So he said, what do you mean? I said, so you want something, okay. So he said, what do you mean? I said, I'll spell it out for you. The shul is giving you a service. And what you're saying is, I want a different service. So what? If you want to be a member who helps give the service, if you're willing to sweat with us in making the shul a reality, if you're willing to come in and say, I want to help, I want to be a part of giving in the shul, then you can affect what the shul gives. But if you walk into the shul as a client and you say, look, the shul is giving me free of charge, free shiurim, free education for my kids, free davening, free air conditioning, we arrange the shul for you, we clean up after you, we clean up the floor, we do a million things to service you. And now you walk in and say, I want a different service. So I say, so what? So you want a different service. So, what have you done in this shul? You want to be a part of the giving in the shul. You want to be a part of those who actually do. Then you can affect what the shul gives. If you're just walking in and saying, I'd like davening to start 5 minutes later. So you want davening to start 5 minutes later. So what? Have you walked in ever early enough to unlock the door? Have you worked on making sure the lights are shut when you leave the shul? There's a lot that goes into running a shul. Lama nigara is the attitude that says there's something positive, I want to be a part of it. Being a part of it means I'm not coming and making requests, complaints, demands. I'm coming and saying, where can I be a member of what's positive here? How can I be a part of the giving force? People make this mistake, especially in the tshuva process. When a person is a chozer b'tshuva, you come to a yeshiva, you come to a host family, and on some level you've been working hard. But it's you working to develop you. And the yeshiva and the host family and the people around you are giving a certain service. They want to help you and be partners in your success. But then a person comes and they say, I'm a part of the family, right? Wrong. If you're a part of the family, then you show up early to help beforehand. You stay late to clean up afterwards. The people who show up to the Seder and at the end of the Seder, they walk out and say, thanks a lot, good night. Everyone's tired at the end of the Seder. It's 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. Who's going to sweep and clean up? So you wanted a service, then you're not a part of the family. Then you're a client. To be a part of the family, to be a part means I'm a part of the giving. Lama nigara means I want to be a part of what's positive. Being a part of what's positive is not just to receive, it's to give. It's to be a part of the giving. And again, it's an attitude. There are people who walk into shul and say, how can I help? There are people who walk into any organization and say, I'm here, how can I help? I had a friend whose wife had incurable cancer. And her whole period in the hospital, while she was waiting, she would join the medicinal clown to make other patients happy. She said, what am I going to do while I'm waiting here? So she asked the medicinal clown, can I figure out how to be a part of your jig? And she, during her wait, she'd go and make other patients happy. She once went to visit one oncology patient. Her leg was all riddled with cancer. She couldn't walk on her leg. So she got herself a scooter. And she put her bad leg on a scooter, and she'd go with the medicinal clown with her other leg, scooting along the hospital. So one time they visited one oncology patient, and they're trying to make him happy. And at one point he looks at her and says, "You know, it's easy for you to say you're healthy." So she looked at the clown and he looked back at her, and they didn't know to laugh or cry. She knew she wasn't going to live out the year. And she didn't. But she knew that for the time that she's there, she's going to be a part of what's positive there. Lama nigara, these great people teach us an attitude. Why shouldn't I be a part of what's positive? What Rabbi Gifter said, why not me? I should also be a part of that. When we aspire to greatness, that's how we can get there. And here I'm touching also on what we discussed in last night's class. We have to set ourselves goals. I would like to visit every one of you. And in 10 or 20 years, I want to see you sitting in the front of the shul, not in the back of the shul. If you're not the rabbi, then you should be the gabbai or the president. You should be the ones that are helping things move forward. Not everything is based on knowledge or wealth. A lot is based on desire. If you want to be a part of things, then you can make things happen. We had someone join our shul 7-8 months ago. And today he has more keys than almost every member of the shul. Because 7-8 months ago when he joined, he right away asked, "What can I help with?" And he followed through. He said, "I see your bulletin board. Someone needs to retype up those signs. Can I do that?" By the end of the week, we had new signs all typed up. And everything that happened, he'd always look, "Can I help with A? Can I help with B? Can I help with C?" 7 months later, he's not even here a year, and today he's an integral part of the shul. So he can make changes. He ends up making changes. He ends up affecting the direction. Lama nigara, there's something, I want to be a part of it. So Moshe turns to Hashem, and Hashem tells him the concept of Pesach Sheni, that we will have a second chance. On a month after Pesach, on the 14th of Iyar, there's a Pesach Sheni. People who couldn't make it for the first one can make the second one. Well, was this part of God's plan for the Torah? What would have happened if these gentlemen would not have walked in? Was Hashem planning on giving us this second chance? So we have a tradition that yes, this was part of this was a mitzvah that was predestined to come to the world, irrespective of their request. However, Hashem allowed them to be the ones who implored to have this opportunity because they had done mitzvos. They became defiled to deal with their cousins, Nadav and Avihu. So here we have a concept. I'll get to you in 1 second. Here we have a concept called Megalgelin Zechut Al Yedei Zakai. Hashem makes good things come to the world through good people. This is a concept that our sages refer to in other contexts as well. Good things come to the world through good people. So we don't only say, you know, it's not my fault. This had to happen. We say, am I the source of good things to the world or bad things to the world? Because we do see it as an indication of how a person is viewed in heaven. Hashem wants to bring good things to the world through good people. Megalgelin zchut, heaven brings meritorious things to the world. Al yedei zakai, through someone who is meritorious. These two did a mitzvah. They went out of their way and they knowingly defiled themselves to deal with their cousins who had died, Nadav and Avihu. So Hashem, through them, taught us the mitzvah of Pesach Sheni. Yes? Could you speak up? No. You're right. I was introducing the concept. Right.
This idea, it's kind of like a second chance, right?
Right.
What is that? Is there some like kesher between like chesed shel emet and the second chance?
I don't know. Think about it. Let me know. Maybe you'll come up with something. I never thought of it.
I mean, I'm thinking about it, but
I don't know. Now we have a mitzvah which appeared earlier, and if we think about it for a moment, it's a very exciting mitzvah. I don't know if you've experienced this, but I've unfortunately come in contact with this. There are people who convert to Judaism And then they go to a college campus, and there's a Yom HaShoah event. And then people who are not learned, and sometimes not even observant, will tell a convert, what does this have to do with you? What are you doing here? All kinds of nasty comments. And it's almost always from people who are not learned and not really connected and are looking for a way to one-up someone else. And it's interesting to note that when the Torah gave us the mitzvah of Pesach, we had not yet received the Torah. And the Torah tells us the convert can join. What's the convert celebrating on Pesach? Explain that one to me. His forefathers weren't enslaved in Egypt. Torah says that's not true. It's a national celebration. You're not celebrating it saying, my great-great-grandfather, whose name was Isidore Frankenthal, he was enslaved in Egypt. No, you have no idea what his name was, right? You don't know. We don't know who it was that was enslaved. As a nation, we're saying our forefathers were enslaved. We celebrate this day that Hashem took us out. Well, they're a part of the nation, an equal part of the nation. And it's not enough that the Torah said it when we were still in Egypt. It's one of the first mitzvot in the Torah, which is a little bit mind-boggling. Over here, the Torah reiterates it. When the Torah comes back to the commandment of Pesach, numerous times the Torah reiterates it. It's as though the Torah says, when you celebrate your national holiday, when you celebrate the day you became a nation, when you celebrate the great miracles that formed you into a nation, remember that the convert is your equal. Kager, kezrach. That it's chukachat. It's one system, and you're all part of that system. Chukachat. And that brings us to Ravi. The Torah describes that we had a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. That pillar of fire was pretty tremendous, if you think about it for a minute. You had a camp of 2 million people. That's a huge camp. You're talking about a camp the size of Kiryat Moshe, Givat Shaul, Har Nof. You're talking about a huge area the Jewish people were taking up.
Double Jerusalem. Not land-wise, camping. But like population-wise.
Okay. Now, you had one pillar in the front, a fire that gave light to the end of the camp. That had to be a pretty awesome pillar to give light to the whole camp. That was no small pillar. And the pillar of cloud had to be seen by everyone as well, by day. They didn't always know how long they would wait until the pillar would move. But they knew they were waiting until the pillar moved, and that's when they would travel.
Isn't it a bit weird though? Like, wouldn't that bring them to kind of smoch al amudim?
That what?
We do what the Amud does. Like we. Is that because it's a direct expression of like Moshe and Hashem, or like, I don't know. It sounds weird. Like they're kind of like doing whatever robotically, whatever these Amudim do.
Well, they took time, right? Right. They were like the Rambam writes. Hashem sometimes gives us physical things to see that are revelations of Hashem's presence in our midst. Hashem doesn't appear physically, but He makes a pillar of cloud, or what we call sometimes Shekhinah, so we can see a representation. Yes.
I couldn't, like, but I can't imagine. Like I have a problem if I'm like praying and I see like whatever chuvet like this with a picture of a rabbi in front of it. I have to.
Right, you're not praying. They weren't praying to the pillars. The that was clear. Receiving man every morning is not weird. Hashem commands Moshe to make for himself two trumpets of solid silver. No one else is going to use it. This is Moshe's recognition as king. When they'd blow two trumpets, everyone was supposed to gather. When they'd blow one trumpet, so only the leaders, the Nesim, were to gather. When they'd blow two trumpets, Tkiah, Trua, Tkiah, so then that was a sign we're traveling. If we're going to war, so we also blow the trumpets. And on Yom Tov and Rosh Chodesh, over the sacrifices, they also blew the trumpets. And the Torah says this would commemorate us before Hashem. In some way, the trumpet is like a representation of our prayer. So you guys know the famous mashal of Rav Soloveitchik about the shofar, right?
No.
No. Okay.
This sounds like Tehillim 150.
Okay. So, let's imagine a brother and a sister. Okay? What are we going to call the brother, Gabriel? Jacob. What are we going to call the sister? I didn't hear you?
Rivka.
Okay. Jacob and Rivka are two teenagers. And it's Matzei Shabbos. It's a wintry Matzei Shabbos. It's early. And Jacob tells Rivka, my friends are going out tonight. I want to borrow Dad's car. Rivka says, so do I, but good luck. He goes down and he goes, Dad, my friends are going out tonight. Can I borrow the car? And his father says, no. So Jacob goes, but Dad, all my friends are going. I want to join them. I've been studying well. I could use the night off. And his father says, I don't know. I don't see you working so hard, and I'm not sure I'm happier with those guys. And anyways, why should you start the week on a late night? You're going to end up staying up late, and your whole week is going to be shot. No, go a different time. Don't go tonight. No. So Jacob starts arguing, and his father argues back. And then his father tells him, look, in the way you drive, I'm not sure I want you behind the wheel at this hour. Back and forth and back and forth. And Jacob gives up. He comes back, and he says, okay, good luck. I got nowhere. What was her name? Rivka. So Rivka goes down. Her father is sitting reading the newspaper. She doesn't talk to him. She just sits down at the table, starts looking at a recipe, and she's reading the recipe, and she has this dismal look on her face. She doesn't say a word. The father looks up, says, Rivka, what's wrong? Nothing, Dad. She goes to the sofa. Now she has her father's attention, and she sits there really looking at her notes. And her father gets up and he goes, Rivka, what's wrong? She says, no, I don't want to bother you, Dan. It's okay. And she sits there with this really sad look on her face. And then she starts sniffling. And her father says, Rivka, why don't you talk to me? And she says, no, Dad, you're busy. Go do what you have to do. And she starts crying. And he says, Rivka, I understand something's wrong, but why don't you tell me what's wrong? Maybe I can help. She doesn't say anything. She's just crying. She says, look, I know maybe you need some time off. Maybe you should just take the car and go with your friends tonight and what's the difference between what she did and what he did? If you try to talk, so speech has its limitations. But if you come in and you just an innocent cry, then you've pierced all logic. You're just saying, it hurts me. Do you care? It hurts me. A cry is the weeping, says Rav Soloveitchik, is the purest form of expression. I need something. Without saying what, without saying why, it's just an expression. This is important to me. And it's a cry. And Rav Soloveitchik says, that's why the blowing of the shofar is called Yivava. A cry, a wailing. Even the cry of Sisra's mother. What a cruel conversation she has with her friends. She says, can you figure out why my son Sisra is late? And then they say to one another, it must be he's violating so many Jewish girls. That's why he's late in coming back to Chatzor. They were the enemies of Israel. They were attacking Israel during the period of Judges. And this is what this vile woman says to her friends. And our sages say, nonetheless, her tears over her son had significance in heaven. And they carried a weight. So the cry, when a person cries, there's something pure about a cry. It's a pure emotion. When Esav cries, as bad as Esav is, it has an impact. It says centuries later, Mordechai had to undo the weeping of Esav. The decree against the Jewish people in the time of Esther and Mordechai was to some degree the product of Esav's tears. So tears, a cry, carries a weight in heaven. Rav Soloveitchik says that's the idea of the shofar. And it would seem, taking Rav Soloveitchik's idea one step further, it would seem that that's also the idea of the trumpets. The trumpets, it says, bring a commemoration of the Jewish people. It says in the Rishonim that when we say Yalev Yovo, what we're saying is, I don't have trumpets. Hashem, when we had trumpets, you said that the trumpets, so to speak, would call your attention. That Lizikaron, Hashem says, I'll focus on you and I'll bring to mind, what do you need? It will be, so to speak, in heaven's focus. What do the Jewish people need? So on Rosh Chodesh we blow trumpets. On a fast day we blow trumpets. When we say Yalev Yovo, so we're saying our needs should come before you. Yale, they should ascend. Viyavo, they should come, enter. Viye ra'e, they should be seen. Viye ratze, they should find favor. Right? Why are we saying all these terminologies? We're saying, if we had a trumpet today, then it would be that simple. We'd blow the trumpet and we know that that would be the equivalent of the greatest prayer. We don't have that. So may it be your will that Yale, Viyavo, Viye Ra'e, Viye Ratze, Viyishama, Viyipaked, Viyizacher. Right? We end up Viyizacher corresponding to the Zikaron of the trumpets. Okay, we've hit Chamishi. And now a full year has passed. Right? We left Mitzrayim. We made it to Sinai. A year has passed since the Exodus from Egypt and we had our second Paschal offering. Another month passes and we have Pesach Sheni. And now, a week later, it's the 6 days have passed, it's the 20th of Iyar, and we are traveling for the first time.
I'm sorry, I'm going back. I try to answer myself, but I'm not managing to. When was there a time of Tara, like Kalit for all of Am Yisrael before Matan Torah?
Yes.
And then Nadav and Avihu is after Matan Torah?
Way after. It's Rosh Chodesh Nisan.
This is the first time they're traveling from Har Sinai since they got there.
Right. Correct. So we're traveling, and in front we have the ark with the broken tablets. The broken tablets have their God's handiwork, right? They're a physical thing that Hashem gave us, right? The Torah is spiritual. Hashem teaches Moshe the Torah and he writes it down. The Luchos are the only physical thing that we have that comes from heaven to earth. The only physical thing that really connects heaven and earth. What?
Since Adam, right? The man would come, but it would go as well.
Okay, if you want to call the man, then you could say rain also. You could say a lot of things. Okay. And we're traveling, the Luchos are traveling in front of us, and the Aron is called Aron Berit Hashem. The Aron that has the broken tablets is called the Aron of the Covenant of Hashem. Now, there's a phenomenal lesson in that. When couples show up and ask to get divorced, one of the first things we tell them is that many couples have reached this stage. Many couples have come to the point where they said, we're filing for divorce, and then they worked out their issues, and they ended up having a much better marriage after they worked out their issues, better than they had until they filed for that divorce. The filing for divorce was the impetus to fix the issues they had, and then they ended up having a much, much better life together. Imagine a couple that has a marriage, and then the marriage hits a terrible bump in the road, and they go to file for divorce, and they're finishing to fill out the papers, and then in the last minute they decide they're going to undergo therapy, and they undergo therapy. And after a lot of work, they've rebuilt their marriage. And one day, they take those papers that they were filing for divorce, and together they tear them. And then they frame them. And then they say, we overcame that. Our bond is stronger than that. The Shivrei Luchos, the ark that has the broken tablets, represents the idea that even though things were that bad, we're still together. Now, the concept, that's why that's called the Ark of the Covenant. Because what binds us is, can we stand by our partner when things are really bad? Now, I want us to take this very personally. Because we know we'd like someone who would do that for us. But are we prepared to be the someone who does that for someone else? And again, in life, people find themselves with tremendous disappointments. You get married and suddenly you discover that you married a gambler. You get married and suddenly you discover that your spouse is a drinker. You get married and suddenly you discover that your spouse doesn't daven every day. You get married and you discover all kinds of weaknesses, human flaws that you had no way of knowing were there. Or if you knew they were there, you didn't realize how severe they were. And then you have to decide, I'm going to make this work. And that always happens. But then life throws at us challenges where our weaknesses enter the spotlight. And suddenly as a married couple, we pay hefty prices for those weaknesses. And suddenly you have to foot the bill for your spouse's weaknesses. And it's at that point that you have to ask yourself, am I that faithful partner? We know we want someone else who's going to be there for us, but am I willing to be there for someone else? There's a story of a Rebbe who was supposed to be set up with a girl, and the girl kept refusing, so he said, I want to meet the girl. So he met the girl and he said to her, look, I know you don't want to marry me because I'm a hunchback, and I understand you, but I'm going to tell you something. In heaven, our souls were together. And in heaven, it was preordained that you would be a hunchback. And when our souls were together, I said, Rabbona Shel Olam, make me a hunchback and not her. But if you're going to say you're not accepting me because of that, that's fine. But I want you to know that tonight I'm going back to heaven and I'm saying switch it.
What a proposal.
I do.
He said, it's your choice, but then I'm switching it. Because I'm not. What I won't do is give up on our marriage because of that. You can stick to your guns, but then I'm going to ask for it to be switched back. And they married. Now,
it worked.
But wait, think of the message. What was he really telling her? You can take it as, you know, the story about the Chassid who walks in and says, "My Rebbe is amazing." They ask him, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, my Rebbe was rushing to catch a train." And the conductor saw him running, and all the Hasidim were running with him. And when he came to the train, the conductor just slammed the door shut and made the train go. And we were all standing there huffing and puffing. And the Rebbe said, the train should crash. And we all pleaded with him. And we said, Rebbe, please, there are so many innocent people on the train. The conductor's the wicked one. Please, abolish the decree. And the Rebbe stood there huffing and puffing. And we said, Rebbe, have mercy. There are women, there are children, there are all kinds. You have Hasidim on the train. And the Rebbe was silent. And we stood there and we said, Rebbe, you can't do that. There's over a million, more than 10 people. The Ribbono Shel Olam would have forgiven Sodom and Gomorrah if there were 10 people there. You can't not forgive them. So the Rebbe thought for a moment and he said, you're right, the train should not crash. And you see, he not only made the decree, he abolished it, the train didn't crash. Okay, so there are Hasidim who will see a story that way, right? Okay, to the Chassid, but you don't have to look at the story that way. Meaning, on a deeper level, what he's telling her is, you don't have a choice whether you're a hunchback or not. I don't have a choice. If we match, then just ask yourself, if things were the inverse, would you want me to say no because of something that's beyond your control? There's nothing. If you tell me you don't like me, if you tell me you don't want to marry me, because that's fine. But if you tell me it's because of something that I can't control, well, think for a second, what would be if you had that? Right, wrong, the message of the story is what's important. Coming back to our parsha. So, the idea that the ark that represented the connection was specifically the ark with the broken tablets, because the broken tablets are what represent an eternal connection. When you have a connection that will overcome challenges, it becomes eternal. And that's one of the messages we tell couples when they come for a divorce. We tell them, you should know, not only have couples overcome this, when they overcome it, it becomes a point of strength. Every hurdle that you pass. Moshe's father-in-law wants to leave. So Moshe tells him, we're traveling to Israel, come, we'll be good to you. And he says, no, I have to go back home. Moshe asks him to join them, and it doesn't say what happened. Torah doesn't tell us. And we have a tradition that he went and brought back his family, and not only did they convert, they became part of the leadership of Israel. It says his descendants were with us past the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. They developed into wonderful families, including the family of Yonadav ben Rechav, that when the Navi Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, wants the Jewish people to have a role model, he says, look at the family of Yonadav ben Rechav. He left them a tradition not to drink wine and not to buy houses. And so they never became arrogant and they never became corrupt. And so Yirmiyahu says, learn from them. The family of Yonadav ben Rechav. So those were descendants of Yisro. You have all the, you had leaders in the Sanhedrin who were descendants of Yisro. Yes. Doesn't say Kanaim, says they, that held them. That tradition held them. Okay, now we have Vayhi Binsa Aharon. So our tradition is that the Torah has seven books. I know they always told you it was five. Our tradition is there are seven. When we began the book of Bamidbar, we discussed then the concept that the book of Bamidbar until Vayhi Binsa Aharon is one book. These two verses of Vayhi Binsa Aharon are a second book. And the book of Bamidbar after these two verses are a third book. So Tosfos is of the opinion that the reason we call it Chumash comes from the word Chamesh. And that's going with the opinion that there are five books of the Torah. But there is an opinion that says there are seven books of the Torah. And it seems like we rule like that opinion. And we have the Parsha of Vayhi Binsa Aharon. So Rabbi Kleiman, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who used to head our English department, used to often give a speech in this week. Very often this week was a week that someone would go off to the army. It always fell out in Parshas Baal Oscha, the enlistment period. And he'd always say, this is a Parsha in its own right. It equals the just like every other book of the Torah. The idea that the Binsa Aharon, that the Ark has to travel. Torah always has to travel with us. You go to the army, you take a little book with you. You know, when I was able to do Shnai Mikravecha Targum, when I bought a little set of Chumash. So then, on the bus rides, in places where you can't always concentrate so well, I was able to get Shnai Mikravecha Targum, little books. The Torah is, that's its own book of the Torah. The idea that the Torah travels with us. Okay, we run into another harsh story of the Jewish people. The people are complaining. Who was complaining? So, maybe it was the Erev Rav. And they're saying, you're traveling too fast for us, this is too hard. So, a fire burns. The nation calls out to Moshe. Moshe prays to Hashem. Vatishka ha'esh. The fire doesn't disappear. The fire sinks somewhere. And the Medrash says it remained and they would continue seeing it. And it's not clear when we read it as a fire, so we read it as a fire, yeah? Like a fire broke out in the camp. It's not clear from the Medrash whether the fire was a physical fire or the fire meant people were breaking out in fevers all around the camp. The Medrash discusses this fire in different ways. In the end of Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, it's not so clear from the Medrash what fire we're talking about here. When the Medrash goes into the fire, and the Medrash says that the fire stuck around afterwards. It says people had desires. Hitavu tava. They wanted to have desires. And that's what Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch discuss. That sometimes a person can be sitting at home and he says, I want to have desires. That's part of our Yetzer Hara.
To have desires?
Yeah. Sometimes a person...
No.
So, well, sometimes a person is not surfing the web. But he turned on that computer. So there's a difference between a person that has something pop up in front of his face and he should have the self-control and shut that screen and say, I don't want to look at this, and that's not where I want to lead my life, to a person who goes and turns on the computer. They desired desire. And they were able to get the whole Jewish people to start crying. And what were they crying about? So the Pasuk says they were crying about meat. And our tradition says they were crying about promiscuity. That when the Pasuk says we remember the fish, so the term fish in Tanakh is a euphemism. When Yaakov blesses his grandchildren that they should multiply, he says v'yidgu larov, v'yidgu. Right? V'yidgu means they should flourish. So he doesn't tell these minors, you guys should have a lot of kids. He says you should be like fish, v'yidgu larov. That's a euphemism for procreation. So they said, we remember the promiscuity we had in Egypt, chinam. Chinam means there were so many women we could marry. Life was so much easier then. No real marriage, no real application. Yeah, we'll get there. Yes. Yes. Yeah. They had meat. They had meat. They had plenty of meat. It says they took out a ton of cattle with them. They had a lot of meat. They had a lot of cattle. They were looking to complain.
Being Jews.
They were looking for an angle to complain, and unfortunately, this is a weakness we have in our personality. Even when things are great. Right. Even when things are great, there's always room to find a place to complain. They said, we remember the fish we ate. In Tanakh, the term to eat is very often a euphemism for intimacy. And so they're saying, we remember the potential we had back in Egypt. And this was a baseless complaint. The greatest gift we have from the Torah is the family structure that the Torah gives us. If there's one thing that is the envy of the whole world, it's the Jewish family. Ishu Beito. But this was their complaint. And so the Torah describes the blessings of the man. And Moshe hears the people crying. And Hashem was upset and Moshe was upset. Our sages say this reflects the attitude that the Jewish people would have forever to marriage. Chazal say there are mitzvos that we as a people adopted with love and happiness, like the mitzvah of the circumcision. As difficult as that mitzvah is, we adopted it with happiness. And so till today, Jews celebrate over a circumcision. You don't see fights breaking out at a circumcision. However, when it comes to marriage, it says the Jewish people made a big fuss, as we see in our parsha, about the laws of marriage. And so it says ever since, every marriage has its fights. It says the fights that surround the wedding ceremony, what color scheme it's going to be, what height mechitza it's going to be, what's the last course going to be. I know people who decades later are still complaining about the dessert that the other side insisted they should serve. If that's what's important, Chazal say it's built into the marriage. That ever since we were complaining and fighting over the laws of marriage, so this is a mitzvah that we accepted with complaints, and so it remained within us as a mitzvah we do with complaints.
Where do we get this from? Like, where is the...
So Gemara.
No, the Pesuk in the Torah that brought up this subject.
Vayitlonenu, vayilonu. Vayishuvu, vayivku. Zacharnu tadaga asher nochal b'mitzrayim chinam. That's a Gemara in Yuma.
Okay, and this is all that is to marriage?
Correct. So Gemara in the last chapter of Yuma. So Moshe says to Hashem, where am I going to be able to give them all their needs? Why do I have this responsibility? Kill me. I can't handle a task which I have no way of living up to. And so the Ribon Shalom says, okay, I will appoint 70 elders. Take them outside the camp, and then I will appear to you, and off of you, I will also appear to them. And here we have a concept that when one person grows in spirituality, people next to him, even if they aren't as worthy as him, they can grow with him as well. When the Shekhinah descends on one prophet, the person standing next to him, even if he is unworthy, can also get prophecy. Elijah, Elio is at home, and the enemies have sent troops to surround his house. And the lad asks him, "What are we going to do, sir? Look around. There are troops all around us." And so he prays. He says, "Ribon Shalom, please reveal his eyes." And it says his eyes were revealed, and he saw all around them, they had chariots of fire and soldiers. He saw angels all around them. And he said, "You see, we have more soldiers on our side than they have on theirs." And then Hashem made all the enemy soldiers go blind, and he led them into the capital, and he gave them to the king, and he said, "Here are the people who came into our territory." Now, the lad was not worthy of seeing the angels, right? But when he stood next to the prophet, he can gain because he's standing next to him. And that's what happens with Moshe and the 70 elders. Now, we will pick up here, Be'ezrat Hashem, on Thursday night in a discussion of what happened here with Miriam, what happened here with the discussion about Moshe, what happened with Moshe's wife. We have a lot to discuss. Be'ezrat Hashem, Thursday night, we'll pick up with our parsha, Be'ezrat Hashem.